Work is sacred. Work is a gift from God that He gives us so that we can enjoy meaning and purpose and significance in our daily lives. But that enjoyment is not automatic. We're all affected by sin. Work is affected by sin. It's been distorted and twisted. And as a result, some people love work. Some people hate it. Some are indifferent to it. Some work too much. Some work too little. Some don't work at all. We desperately need to recover a biblical theology of work. And that has been one of our primary purposes in this series. Now, 2 weeks ago, we began to look at some biblical characters who served God faithfully in the marketplace. And our goal there was to find out what it was about their characters or their actions or their perspectives that enabled them to impact their world, their work world, effectively for God. We started with Joseph, whose hallmark was integrity. Joseph's first job was as a slave. His second job was as a steward in a prison, and he was one of the prisoners. His third job was as prime minister of all of Egypt. But no matter where he served or in what capacity he served, Joseph exhibited the same admirable characteristics: integrity, competence, hard work, resistance to temptation, and refusal to take revenge. Last Lord's Day, Pastor Dick brought a great message about two workmen who were artistic craftsmen, Bezalel and Oholiab. God is a lover of beauty, you know. All you have to do is open your eyes to see that. God has put creativity in us, some more, some less. And He's put in us an aesthetic sense to enable us to enjoy the beauty that is created. When people use their artistic abilities for God, all of our lives are enhanced. I remember the statement of Eric Little in Chariots of Fire: "I believe God made me for a purpose, but He also made me fast. And when I run, I feel His pleasure." Friends, that's a statement that any artist could make. When I paint, I feel His pleasure. When I sing, I feel His pleasure. When I sculpt, I feel His pleasure. But what we need to realize is that that's possible for every one of us, whether we're an artist or not. All of us should be able to say about something, "When I do that, I feel God's pleasure." I say, "When I study and teach, I feel God's pleasure." When Amy Michaelis cooks, I'm sure she says, "When I cook, I feel His pleasure." At least all the rest of us feel it. When Evan L. Olinger probably says, "When I help a special needs child, I feel God's pleasure." When Greg Johnson finishes a remodeling project, "I feel God's pleasure." In fact, one of the signs that we have found our niche in life, that thing that God specially created us for, is that we feel that pleasure. I'm not suggesting to you that you have to enjoy everything in life. As long as we are in a fallen world, there are going to be some responsibilities we have that we are not going to enjoy, but we must do them because it's the right thing to do. But what a blessing to be in a career where one fits. And that would be my prayer for all of us here today. And I would suggest that if you're not there, pray that God might change your heart toward your career. Or pray that God might give you a new one. Today I want to examine another situation from the life of Moses. This one doesn't fit neatly into the pattern that we have set of dealing only with lay people, no priests and no prophets. For the two key characters in this story are a priest and a prophet. But the lesson they provide is so critical for all of us, no matter what our line of work, that I hope you'll overlook that minor issue. Besides, the priest in this story, Jethro, was also a rancher. I think he was just a part-time priest. And the prophet in this story is Moses, who wore a number of secular hats as well. I want us to read Exodus 18 together. But let me first set the context for you. Moses was the prince of Egypt. But even though he grew up in Pharaoh's household, he never lost the consciousness of his Hebrew roots. One day he saw an Egyptian beating a fellow Hebrew, and he killed the man. When he learned that someone had seen that and that Pharaoh had put out a contract on his life, Moses fled the country. He went to Midian, and there he met Jethro, a Midianite priest and rancher, who eventually gave his daughter Zipporah to Moses as his wife. For many years, Moses worked for Jethro, tending his flocks, raising a family, until the Lord one day appeared to Moses in a burning bush and told him, "I want you to go back to Egypt, and I want you to lead my people out of slavery." Moses was very reticent to accept this assignment. But after much encouragement, after a few amazing miracles that God used in his life, and after learning that the Pharaoh had put out the contract on his life, was now dead, Moses went to his father-in-law and asked Jethro to release him, and he accepted God's assignment. And Jethro said to him, "Go, I wish you well." Of course, you're familiar with the story of how Moses went to the new Pharaoh and demanded in the Lord's name, "Let my people go." And how God brought 10 plagues upon the Egyptian people to encourage Pharaoh to let them go. And how even after the last plague, when Pharaoh said, "You can go," he still pursued them. And how Pharaoh and all of his forces were swallowed up in the sea as a judgment from God. The Israelites are free at last. And they travel through the Sinai desert toward the mountain of God, Mount Sinai. At every point in their journey, God meets their need for protection from their enemies, protection from the elements, for food, for drink. And they are almost to Mount Sinai, camped out there, when Jethro shows up one day with Zipporah and Moses' 2 sons, whom he had not seen for perhaps over a year. Let's read from Exodus chapter 18. "Now Jethro, the priest of Midian and father-in-law of Moses, heard of everything God had done for Moses and for his people Israel, and how the Lord had brought Israel out of Egypt. After Moses had sent away his wife Zipporah, his father-in-law Jethro received her and her 2 sons. One son was named Gershom, for Moses said, 'I have become an alien in a foreign land.' And the other was named Eleazar, for he said, 'My father's God was my helper. He saved me from the sword of Pharaoh.' Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, together with Moses' sons and wife, came to him in the desert, where he was camped near the mountain of God. Jethro had sent word to him, 'I, your father-in-law Jethro, am coming to you with your wife and her 2 sons. So Moses went out to meet his father-in-law and bowed down and kissed him. They greeted each other and then went into the tent. Moses told his father-in-law about everything the Lord had done to Pharaoh and the Egyptians for Israel's sake, and about all the hardships they had met along the way and how the Lord had saved them. Jethro was delighted to hear about all the good things the Lord had done for Israel in rescuing them from the hand of the Egyptians. He said, 'Praise be to the Lord who rescued you from the hand of the Egyptians and of Pharaoh, and who rescued the people from the hand of the Egyptians. Now I know that the Lord is greater than all other gods, for he did this to those who had treated Israel arrogantly.' Then Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, brought a burnt offering and other sacrifices to God. And Aaron came with all the elders of Israel to eat bread with Moses' father-in-law in the presence of God. The next day, Moses took his seat to serve as judge for the people, and they stood around him from morning till evening. When his father-in-law saw all that Moses was doing for the people, he said, "What is this you are doing for the people? Why do you alone sit as judge, while all these people stand around you from morning till evening?" Moses answered him, "Because the people come to me to seek God's will. Whenever they have a dispute, it is brought to me, and I decide between the parties and inform them of God's decrees and laws." Moses' father-in-law replied, "What you are doing is not good. You and these people who come to you will only wear yourselves out. The work is too heavy for you. You cannot handle it alone. Listen now to me, and I will give you some advice, and may God be with you. You must be the people's representative before God and bring their disputes to Him. Teach them the decrees and laws and show them the way to live and the duties they are to perform. But select capable men from all the people, men who fear God, trustworthy men who hate dishonest gain, and appoint them as officials over thousands, hundreds, fifties, and tens. Have them serve as judges for the people at all times, but have them bring every difficult case to you. The simple cases they can decide themselves. That will make your load lighter, because they will share it with you. If you do this, and God so commands, you will be able to stand the strain, and all these people will go home satisfied." Moses listened to his father-in-law and did everything he said. He chose capable men from all Israel and made them leaders of the people, officials over thousands, hundreds, fifties, and tens. They served as judges for the people at all times. The difficult cases they brought to Moses, but the simple ones they decided themselves. Then Moses sent his father-in-law on his way, and Jethro returned to his own country. It's better to burn out than rust out. What's a candle for but to burn? I can still remember a Bible camp speaker using statements like these to try to get 150 rambunctious kids to dedicate or rededicate their lives to God. I heard similar statements in Bible college and seminary. And it seemed like the only alternative to burnout was laziness and apathy. But is that true? Is burning out in your job a sign of faithfulness? Or is it an unnecessary tragedy? Help in answering that question comes to us today from a very unlikely source. A rancher, a part-time priest, who spared one of God's greatest leaders from almost inevitable burnout. And he can help us too, if we will let him. But first we need to consider the fact that burnout is a frequent malady among people in many lines of work, particularly in the people helping professions. What is it? I think it's a term borrowed from rocket science. As a rocket takes off from its foundation and it runs out of fuel, it burns out and falls back to earth. In one sense, the metaphor may be a bit self-congratulatory. I know some people who claim to be burnt out, and I don't think they've ever left the launching pad. But be that as it may, burnout has become a commonly diagnosed syndrome. There are scores of books that have been read on the subject. I Googled burnout and found exactly 18,300,000 references to it. And I would have looked all of them up, but I didn't want to burn out, of course. Now, a definition might be helpful to us today. Burnout is a syndrome of emotional exhaustion and cynicism that occurs frequently among individuals who do people work of some kind. As emotional resources are depleted, workers feel they are no longer able to give of themselves at a psychological level. Among those who are most susceptible to burnout are those who have conflict that is unresolved or frustrations that they have not taken care of, and those who are extremely dedicated and committed. I think Christians are unusually susceptible because Christians are often possessed with a heavy sense of responsibility. And besides, They want to please God in their careers. Why does it happen? I think there are probably three most common factors in burnout. One is a sense of indispensability. This can affect Christian leaders, whether clergy or laity. It's a subtle sense that God can't get along without them. They've been called to do a task, but if they don't do it, it won't get done. Of course, this is not really true, is it? The Scriptures go to some length to indicate to us that while God wants to use us, His plan for the universe is not really dependent upon us. Nevertheless, such feelings are common. Secondly, there is often a sense of basic inadequacy. It may seem contradictory to the first, the sense of indispensability, but I think it's actually complementary to it, not contradictory. Burnout victims are often people who lack genuine self-esteem at the deepest roots of their personhood. And that drives them to prove their value and their worth by overwork and perfectionistic tendencies. Third, there's a failure to consider and take care of the needs of the whole person. Physical, emotional, spiritual. If you work too hard, if you don't get enough sleep, and if you neglect your body, your emotions, your psyche, your spiritual walk with God are all going to be negatively affected. You can count on it. When these three tendencies are combined in the same person, burnout is almost inevitable. But there are other contributing factors to the problem of burnout. I just listed a few here for you to look at. Unrealistic expectations of work. Unrealistic analysis of our gifts and abilities. Job saturation. That means taking work home with you, taking it on the road with you, always having work on your mind. Indefinite job descriptions. Lack of evaluation. Unexpressed appreciation. Lack of support from loved ones. Ungrateful clients, ungrateful fellow workers. Some of you can relate to these items, can't you? What are the symptoms of burnout? What are some of the warning signs that should cause us to sit up and take notice, either in our own lives or in the lives of some loved ones? Well, I only have time to mention a few. Emotional exhaustion, low energy levels. Sleepiness in the daytime, insomnia at night, paranoia, irritability, and worry, loss of discipline at work or in other areas of life, feelings of hopelessness, anger at those making demands on us, self-criticism for putting up with those demands, frequent headaches and gastrointestinal disturbances, weight loss or gain. And what are the results? I mention this only to indicate how serious the issue can be. Job loss is not infrequent. Broken relationships, shame and embarrassment, depression, and even suicide. Robert Murray McShane graduated from Edinburgh University at age 14. And by age 23, he pastored a large Presbyterian church of 1,000 people, and that was in a day and age when mega churches were very uncommon. Before dying at the age of 29, he wrote, "God gave me a message to deliver and a horse to ride. Alas, I have killed the horse, and now I cannot deliver the message." McShane judged that he had been a poor steward of the gifts God had given him. He had squandered his life, not in riotous living, but in riotous serving. Did you ever think that you could do that? He thought he had. And this is a possibility not only for preachers, but also for people in the marketplace. You can waste your life by laziness, or you can waste it by workaholism. Either way, you have wasted it. Now in Exodus 18, we have a clear example of a godly man who narrowly averted burnout. I think if we take seriously the solution that was offered to him and that he accepted, we can go a long way to preventing burnout in our own lives. Exodus 18 makes it very clear that Moses is a prime candidate for burnout. First thing I see here is his single-mindedness. I already told you that Moses was extremely reluctant to accept God's assignment to lead the people out of Israel, out of Egypt. But once he accepted the assignment, he gave his whole self to that. One of the ways this shows up is his willingness to send his wife and sons back to Midian. If you examine the details of the story back in Exodus 4, you find that Moses took his wife and his two sons with him when he went back to Egypt. And his father-in-law Jethro gave him permission to do that. But they didn't stay very long. Whether it was because Zipporah got homesick or Moses realized there was too much danger in his work of leading the children out of Egypt, he sent them back to Midian and back to Jethro. I suggest this willingness on his part to be separated from his family for an extended period of time, many, many months, perhaps even a couple of years, indicates that he was incredibly single-minded. But I don't think that's all positive. While I don't think there's enough evidence in this case to make a certain evaluation, it's my opinion that rarely, if ever, will God give us an assignment that requires extended separation from the spouse and children that He has also given to us. No matter how much money you earn, or how much fame you achieve, or even how much spiritual satisfaction you get from your work, it is probably not worth the stress and strain of extended absence from one's family. I'll go a little further in my observation about the single-mindedness of Moses. When his family arrives for a visit, as they are camped just short of Mount Sinai, it says in verse 7 of Exodus 18, "So Moses went out to meet his father-in-law and bowed down and kissed him. They greeted each other and then went into the tent. Moses told his father-in-law about everything the Lord had done to Pharaoh and the Egyptians for Israel's sake." See anything odd about that? Is there anything missing from that story? He doesn't kiss his wife. He doesn't play ball with his boys, though he hasn't seen them for a coon's age. What's Moses up to here? He is so focused on what God had assigned him to do. And questions about his single-mindedness are only heightened as we look at his schedule. Verse 13. "The next day, Moses took his seat," still no mention of his family, "to serve as judge for the people, and they stood around him from morning till evening." Now, in his capacity as judge, Moses is applying God's will to the lives of the people. I can't think of a more important job anybody could possibly have. But this is a killer schedule. And the implication is that this is normal for Moses. He must have been running on pure adrenaline. And frankly, I both admire and pity him. I admire his willingness to do this, but I pity him because what he is attempting to do is inhuman. Well, why did he do it? What were his motives? I think one has to do a bit of sacred psychoanalysis of Moses at this point to separate his conscious motives from his unconscious ones. I think his conscious motives were pure. He talks about them a little bit. Verse 15, he protests that he's doing a necessary work for a needy people. I have no problem that he really believes he's doing the right thing. But I also suspect there are some subconscious motives operating here. Moses, we already know, lacks self-confidence. He doesn't have very high self-esteem. When God called him to this job, he said, "Not me, Lord. Find somebody who knows how to talk." He said, "I stutter. I can't do this job." Well, he did finally agree to do it, but I don't think his lack of self-esteem was cured in a day. It's quite common, friends, for an insecure leader to be a driven leader. After all, he dare not let people down because he needs and desperately desires their approval to affirm his personal worth. The long lines of people waiting to see Moses are a constant affirmation to Moses that he is needed and therefore he is valuable. I know the feeling. I came here in 1975 as a young man who had never pastored before. And I had perfectionistic tendencies. I wanted to do a good job. I wanted people to affirm me. And I remember the day I arrived. We came on a Wednesday, driving a truck from Miami. And as we were unloading the furniture, a man in the church came up and said, "Hey, it'd be really great to have you come to the church softball game tomorrow night." When my wife heard that I agreed to do that, she said, "You're going to do what? The beds aren't even assembled yet." By Sunday, I was preaching Sunday morning, Sunday night. Started a Wednesday night Bible study. Within 3 weeks, maybe two, my sermon barrel was empty. I had never pastored before, you know. And I didn't have a Sunday off for 6 months. Now, why did I do that? Well, I guess I didn't know any better. Apparently, the elders didn't know any better either because nobody tried to stop me. But I think underneath that was an insecurity, a deep desire to be appreciated and affirmed, and I was willing to work my head off in order to get that. Over the years, I've come to a little better understanding of who I am and of my own dispensability. But even now, there are times when my schedule is completely full and someone will call out and say, "I need to see you." Instead of saying, "You know, I've got time Thursday," I'll say, "Yeah, come on over." There's something deliciously tempting about that need to be needed. But it's not healthy, friends. Many of you have experienced the same thing in your jobs. Some of you would work your heads off for a boss who would just affirm you constantly. But you're not doing it for the Lord. You're doing it because you desperately need affirmation. Such a situation sows the seeds of burnout. In 1983, I nearly crashed and burned. And it wasn't a pleasant situation, I'll tell you. It still troubles me when I think about it. And I had to go to a counselor and say, "What's wrong with me?" And in about 20 minutes, he said, "You're clinically depressed." He could have said, "You're burned out," but the term wasn't a common term in those days, but it was the same thing. And he helped me get my life back in order. And part of that was changing my schedule. Over the years, I've done better with that. But as I say, not completely well. But there was one man in Moses' life who was concerned enough and courageous enough and had insight enough to rescue Moses before he hit the skids. Let's be really honest about it. His concern may not have been entirely selfless. After all, he is the father of Moses' wife and the grandfather of Moses' children, and he sees what this is doing to his family. He speaks sadly about the fact that both Moses and the people are getting worn out by this. Moses by working too hard and the people by standing in line too long. But concern rarely accomplishes anything unless we have the courage to do something. Jethro speaks up and says to Moses, "What you're doing is stupid. You and these people who come to you will only wear yourselves out. The work is too heavy for you. You cannot handle it alone." I don't want you to underestimate the courage it took for him to do this. Would you go up to Charles Swindoll or Charles Stanley or John MacArthur and tell them, "You guys are working too hard. writing books, speaking at conferences, pastoring huge mega churches, that is not smart. No, you wouldn't do that. I wouldn't do that. But Jethro was willing to do that. You say, well, I'm not Charles Stanley's father-in-law either. But since when is it easier to tell an in-law they're doing something stupid than to tell a total stranger? Believe me, this took a lot of courage on Jethro's part. But he not only had concern and courage, he also had some insight to offer. If you're going to criticize, it's best to offer a solution. And he does. He first encourages Moses to continue to accept the assignment God has given him. That is to be the people's representative before God. But he needs a major change in how he fulfills that responsibility. He needs to do more teaching. Show the people what the truth is. If you fill them with God's truth, they're not going to have so many problems. They're not going to have so many conflicts. And then he tells him to turn the administration over to other people. Actually has them divide into groups. There'll be a man over 10 families. And he'll solve the minor disputes between those families. If he can't solve them, he sends it up to the guy who's in charge of 50 families, and then 100 families, and then 1,000 families. This is what our judicial system is based on, friends. We have a Supreme Court, but they don't handle all the disputes. They handle, 30, 40 cases a year is all. Under them are appeals courts, and under them are district courts, under them are state courts, and then local courts, and justices of the peace. This is a biblical concept that is offered here by this man, Jethro. The benefits of Jethro's plan are twofold. Moses will be able to stand the strain, and all these people will go home satisfied because they won't have to stand in line too long. Frankly, I think Jethro ought to be a saint. Saint Jethro. Anybody who can lower the time we stand in line is a hero in my book. I hate to stand in line. One applause there. Now look at Moses' response to this. This is pretty amazing too. Think about this. This Moses is the powerful, esteemed, dedicated, undisputed leader of 2 million people. And yet it says he listened to his father-in-law and he did everything he said. Isn't it any wonder God said Moses was the meekest of all men? He was willing to learn from a rancher and a part-time, once pagan priest. Quickly now, I want us to consider the final point. And that is that God's will for us is not to burn out, but rather to be poured out. I don't want to leave you with the impression that Christian workers should take it easy, that leisure and pleasure should be the focus of their life, and they should look out for number one. I don't believe that at all. I have always been a hard worker. I've always worked 6 days a week, my whole adult life, but not seven. And God Himself worked 6 days, but then He rested. Instead of looking out for number one and desperately trying to climb the corporate ladder and accumulating more stuff, we should be going hard after God, friends. Glorifying Him through our bodies, our minds, and our spirits. The question is, how is God best glorified? Is it by burning the candle at both ends? Or is it by balanced Christian living? And I think you know the answer to that. Nowhere in the Bible will you find God encouraging His people to burn themselves out through overwork. He does encourage us to commit our lives completely to Him. He encourages us to be willing to do anything He requires, to make any sacrifice, including the sacrifice of our lives. But the difference between being burned out and being poured out is that the former is usually the result of dedication to our own agenda, while being poured out is dedication to God's agenda. In an obedient and balanced fashion. The example of Jesus Christ is extremely helpful here. Jesus spent 30 years preparing for just 3.5 years of ministry. He died prematurely at the age, humanly speaking, at about the age 35, pouring his life out according to the will of his Father. But did Jesus burn out? No way. Never do you get the impression from the life of Christ that he was even in a hurry, much less in a dither. He was more in demand than any of us will ever be. But he knew how to say no. And he often escaped from the crowds to go off to a lonely place and pray. If the only perfect example on earth could say no to demands that were too great for his human body or his human emotions, then dare any of us who follow him be so arrogant as to think that we are more indispensable than he? Quickly, I want to leave you with 3 points to ponder this morning. First, Christians are not exempt from the consequences of breaking life's natural laws. When you accept Christ as your personal Savior, a lot of things happen to you. You're redeemed, you're reconciled, you're filled with the Spirit, just great things. But you don't cease being human. And I'm not aware of a single law of nature that you escape because you're a Christian. If you burn the candle at both ends, instead of being used by God, you will be used up. Secondly, training and delegating is in the long run the most efficient way to get things done. And it's also God's way. For years and years, I lived with the bankrupt notion that if I wanted something done right, I should do it myself. That may be true in the short run, but it is absolutely false in the long run. It will destroy you, and worse, prevent you from realizing the joy that comes through training others so that their God-given talents can be used also. Our job is multiplication, friends, not just addition. We'll never reach the world through addition. We must do it through multiplication. I believe God wants us to turn the rat race into a relay race. And finally, we must not allow the tyranny of the urgent to keep us from doing the important. 1,000 things scream at us every day that they need to be done. But only a few things are really important. Family, health, relationships, worship. The most important, of course, is attending to our relationship with God. Martha was perhaps near burnout when Jesus arrived at her house. And he complained to Jesus, "Lord, don't you care that my sister has left me to do the work by myself? Tell her to help me." And Jesus responded, "Martha, Martha, you are worried and upset about many things, but only one thing is absolutely essential. Mary has chosen the better." That one thing that Jesus speaks of there is worship. Mary was sitting at his feet, worshiping him. And I tell you this, that the person who learns to worship, I'm not talking just about coming to corporate worship, the person who learns that God is in control, God is all-powerful, God deserves praise and adoration and focuses his attention on God in worship, in his daily life, will never suffer burnout. It just won't happen.